You're listening to episode 2 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Yes, that's right. This is GNU World Order. This is my techie show. I'm Cloud 2. This is my technical show about geeky stuff about GNU and Linux and the Unix philosophy and the workspaces that we use when we use Linux and all kinds of interesting topics like that. Today I've got two different topics for you, kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum in a sense. One is GNOME 3, and the other is LVM, and setting it up for a Slackware install, but the background will be good for any OS or any version of Linux that you're using, because of course if you do it for Slackware, you really, really understand what you're doing. So let's get started. Just so happens that a couple of weeks ago, the Kernel Panic Ogcast decided to do a terminal emulator challenge based on an old idea we'd had back, I think, during TIT Radio, when we were doing a desktop challenge where we all had to change our desktop environment for 2 weeks or a month or whatever it was. I don't really remember. But it turned out to be pretty popular with listeners, so for some reason I thought of the idea of changing up terminal emulators. It's kind of a weird idea, because if you think about it, a terminal emulator, I mean, typically you just open it up and use the command line, but I thought it might be interesting just to see what else was out there. So everyone kept telling me to try Terminator, which is a GTK terminal emulator with multiple panels. So I thought, okay, maybe I should try that. And around the same time, it just so happened that I am working on some packaging stuff for the NovaCut project, which is a new video editor that's being built, and it's being built around the GStreamer framework, and it's very GTK. So I decided, well, I should just install Fedora 15, but not just any Fedora 15. I should install Fedora 15, the default install, i.e. GNOME 3. So first of all, I have to say that the GNOME 3 install of Fedora 15 honestly has made me completely look at Fedora differently in general. I've only ever used the KDE version of Fedora. That's just my desktop of choice. I like it. That's what I use. But the user experience was completely, completely different. I used to often be puzzled by the idea that Fedora could even be seen as a distribution for a new Linux user. I just thought, why would you do that? Why would you drop them into something so clearly geared toward the developers? Well, it turns out that the Fedora 15, or the Fedora KDE spin, I think, may be a little bit more geared toward developers than the GNOME version. The GNOME version is friendly, it's user-friendly, it's attractive, it's quiet, there's not a lot of notifications popping up all over the place. It's just kind of, I don't know, it's very subtle. Nothing like the KDE version at all. Don't get me wrong, I love the KDE version. When I start itching for the new version of KDE and I don't want to update my Slackware install, which of course I keep very, very stable, Fedora's the place I turn to for all the latest KDE stuff. They do a great job at it. I like Fedora KDE. But this GNOME experience was completely different. It was this easy to use, very clear, simple distribution that I honestly felt like I'd never seen before. But of course I'm getting ahead of myself, so I just wanted to mention that the user experience on the default Fedora install is quite different than the user experience I have had on Fedora KDE, or even I've set up a Fedora XFCE version once on a server, so I've seen other sides of Fedora than KDE, but I've just never seen its flagship product. Maybe once way back when I first installed it on my old iBook G4, I think I was using GNOME at that time, but that was the old GNOME, and I was completely still very new to Linux. So coming to the product that they actually put out and say, yes, this is it, this is Fedora, I was really, really amazed at how nice and friendly and polished it was. As for GNOME 3 itself, first of all, you know that I've never been a fan of GNOME, right? I mean, I've said in the past that GNOME is very nice for people who like it, and it's fine, and, you know, the world should be full of diversity and choice, and so GNOME 2 is quite nice. I was lying. I hate GNOME 2. I've always hated it. I've always felt that it was clunky, ugly, completely designed wrong. I just never understood the three menus up there. I mean, you'd think, oh, this is simplicity. This is true simplicity. There are three small menus up there in the left-hand side, and you can go there and do all kinds of different things. Yeah, well, then why was it so confusing to me? I couldn't stand GNOME 2. I've got no love for GNOME as an interface. I have great respect for it as a project, obviously, but as an interface, couldn't care less. Which means coming to GNOME 3 and looking at it and actually really, really liking it surprised even myself. GNOME 3 is easy to use, it's friendly, it's attractive, it's smart, it's thinking outside the box, it's all of these things. It really, really surprised me. I was amazed. I didn't expect to like this really at all, much less to actually really be fond of it. When I say fond of it, I mean it's fun to use, which is something that I really honestly believe an interface should be. I don't think that you should sit down in front of any application and just think, okay, well, this is just how I have to use it. This is something that I have to do now. You should enjoy it. You should always enjoy the interface that you're using. And generally speaking, I do. When I use Fluxbox, when I use KDE, when I use some of my favorite applications, it's enjoyable to me. And this thing sings. This GNOME 3 is a slick interface. This easily rivals any modern operating system desktop that you look at. I don't care who makes it. I don't care how recent it is. I don't even care if it doesn't exist yet. I mean, there's a time limit on that one. I mean, at some point in the future, this will pale in comparison to an OS, but I'm talking about the ones that are kind of like current right now between the two big other manufacturers of computer operating systems. This one is right there. It's neck and neck. So we can agree that it's beautiful. Big deal, right? But the cool stuff about GNOME 3, for me at least, is the dedicated launcher of applications, which I guess a lot of people don't like. The convention of hitting the little super key and getting zoomed out into like a little control panel, I think that really works. I think it's almost overkill, and yet it really, really works. And I say overkill because what's the nearest equivalent? When I started GNOME 3, I thought, okay, I need to find the run command. And I figured it was probably Alt F2 because that's what I'd heard it usually was on a lot of desktops with if you don't set it to something else. So I tried that, and sure enough, it opened up a little run command, and it did work. I mean, but it was very direct, almost Fluxboxian run command. It didn't give you suggestions. It didn't try to help you try to predict what you were going to say. It was simply a run command. So then I finally discovered the hitting the super key thing and started. At first it was very confusing, didn't get it, didn't understand how it was supposed to work. Someone told me, I think, that if you just start typing, or maybe I found that out, I don't know, start typing and it starts to filter down the applications and you can start an application that way. Well, that's great. That's exactly what I like. That's KRunner. You know, that's that little launcher application. Quick launching with just a couple of key presses. But it also has this great application view, which I love. I can't tell you how much I hate a menu with applications listed in it. I don't understand the point. Even on Fluxbox, if I do make an like one of those little menus with all my applications, it's a very filtered down application menu to just the things that I'm really going to be using. And then you know what? I ultimately never use those. I don't use it via the menu. I use it via keyboard shortcuts. Or the little run command in Fluxbox. I can't stand a menu with all my applications. On a computer, we all typically have so many applications, and no, they don't all fit neatly into categories. Okay, KBlocks fits very neatly into a category. It's a game. I get that. But what about something like Blender? Is that a graphic application? Oh, it sure is, but maybe it's also a multimedia application. Synfig Studio, graphics or multimedia? Even something like LibreOffice, or LibreOffice, the draw component of LibreOffice. Is that a graphics application or is it an office application? The list goes on and on. There's all kinds of different things that just don't make any sense to me. And it's a model that's clearly started with Microsoft Windows. I can't imagine why anyone who would dislike Microsoft would choose to continue to emulate their idea of how they should sort applications in one big long list menu with all your applications seemingly randomly organized into arbitrary categories for you. It makes so much more sense to me, and this is a very rare thing that I feel this way about, but it really does make a lot more sense to just dump all of your applications into a folder or a virtual location and just let you sort through it. You know the name of the thing, or you can scroll through the list, look at the icon, get an idea of what it may do, get intrigued by the name, whatever makes you interested in it enough so that you actually click on it and launch it and learn about your applications. That's enough. You don't need them in a menu. So really, really love that little application view. And then you've got your obligatory categories off to the right-hand side, so you get best of both worlds right there. You also can, in that same little control panel, you can have a 4-up, or not a 4-up, it depends on how many windows you have, but you can have a display of your open applications, and you can switch between them. Now, right now, because it's 3.0 that I'm using, GNOME 3.0, there's no easy way to switch back and forth between the two applications. I imagine that's something, I hope that's something that they will fix. You can't just zoom out to your overview and kind of tab between the two or select them as far as I can tell in any way except for the mouse. So that's kind of weird. But anyway, back to this view, this control panel view. Not only do you have your little windows, a list of all your applications, and you've got your categories. You've also got, in your Windows view, you've got all of your open desktops off to the right side, and it retracts when you're not looking at it, but you can push your mouse over there, and it comes forward, and there's all your desktops. Now you know where your applications are. And yes, you can click and drag them from desktop to desktop, just like any normal virtual desktop interface. Brilliant. On the left, okay, there's some kind of weird dock. I have no idea what that's for. It seems really silly to me. I guess that's technically just your favorites, but I don't know. That part I don't care about, but it doesn't offend me either. It's just there. Brilliant little interface. It does everything you need it to do. Not necessarily the most efficiently that you could possibly think of it doing all those things, but, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but it does work. It works really nice, and if you're okay with having one hand on the mouse a lot, then this works just fine. It works really well, actually. So that's great. I was really impressed with that interface, even though I've heard a lot of complaints about it. I thought it was really good. The task manager bar, the task manager thing that lists all of your applications that are open, which you typically see on a Windows box down at the bottom of the screen, doesn't exist in GNOME 3. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I've never been able to stand a task manager. The minute I found out that I could take it off of KDE, that was usually one of the first modifications that I ever made to my desktop. I don't understand the task manager. I don't know why you would ever need it. With Alt-Tab, you have all of your open applications at your fingertips. Why do you need little instances popping up on your desktop every time you open up a thing and then blinking whenever they want your attention? It drives me crazy, so I get rid of that all the time anyway. GNOME 3 saves me the step of getting rid of it. It just doesn't have it. I admire them for that. I really do. Another thing that I'm really, really excited about in GNOME 3 are the overall designs of their applications. Really, they're little system utility tools, and I don't know I don't know if all of this stuff is GNOME 3 or some of it's Fedora or Red Hat. I really don't know who is responsible for this, but there is a fantastic little application called Disk Utility, which is a very familiar term for me from my old OS, and frankly the design of the application is fairly similar. You've got your devices over on the left, and you've got what you can do to those devices over on the right, and if there's nothing to do like format the drive, then there's information about the drive. This is something I've been looking for quite literally since I started with GNU Linux. This was the kind of thing that I really, really needed. I remember that I was really impressed with KDE for their little Kinfo view that you could do in Conqueror if that little plugin was installed or whatever. So that was really, really handy because it lists in a graphical way all of your different hardware devices. I don't think that's so much to ask for. You know, I really think that if you're running a GUI, in order to get all the information about your devices, you shouldn't have to do an LSPCI and a LSPCI verbose and all kinds of catting of proc CPU infos and stuff like that. I think you should just be able to see all of your system in a graphical view in one application. And to date, the only two places I ever really knew to look for, three actually, was K-Info, or whatever that thing is in Conker, where you can see, I think it's K-Info, you could see it in, I think, the Mandriva control panel, and then I think you could see it in sort of in some kind of GNOME thing. I don't really remember, but I think it was in that third menu, counting from the left, the third to the toward the right. Anyway, this view is great. The design is simple and clean, and it's just really, really nice. Another thing that I remember really kind of impressing me was something simple like the sound setting menu, or control panel, rather, in GNOME 3. If you go up to your little speaker icon, you go to sound settings, there's sound settings, and it's very clear as to what you can do with each different device that you've got. It doesn't have a lot of controls, which, you know, I'll get into in a little while. It's nice, though. It's really nice. I like it. Power settings, same idea. You get one little control panel, not a lot of clutter, not that many options, not that many choices. It's just really, really simple. Speaking of simple, the upper right-hand corner of GNOME 3 desktop has a very minimalistic, properly robust control panel. I don't know what you call it, but it's got your typical sort of the sound, the volume, the Wi-Fi, or the network manager, I guess, really is what it would be, the battery level, a user menu, which, by the way, is brilliant, but I don't want to get into that yet. The clock is right dead center in the screen, which I admit I keep looking to the right because every other computer operating system on the planet has it over on the right, but I can get used to it in the middle. I don't care. I don't look at the time that much. When I click on the clock, it gives me a calendar. It gives me access to all of the different events that I might have planned. Not that I actually use those kinds of things, but I do like a calendar that I can click on and get a complete month and access to the date and time settings, little things like that. This user menu over in the right-hand corner is brilliant. I don't know, I'm shocked that other people haven't thought of this before. There's your username. Hey, that's me. That's my username. I can configure this thing to do my IM, my chat account, my Jabber thing, and I'll get little pop-up notifications at the bottom of the screen. It's just, it feels so integrated and so fine-tuned. It's just really, really smart design. I'm really, really impressed, honestly. I'm amazingly impressed. I really didn't expect to get this deep into GNOME 3 and keep finding cool little touches that someone had done. How anyone doesn't like this, I honestly don't understand, except that I know how it is to get used to an environment. And when someone changes that out from under you, okay, I sympathize. It's hard for me to sympathize 100% because, like I've said, I really didn't like GNOME 2. I can't imagine anyone clinging to GNOME 2. But people did know it, people got used to it, and so that's understandable. I do think that it would be kind of neat for GNOME 3 to provide GNOME 2 users not even a fallback, just kind of a different configuration of the desktop. But at the same time, that's extra work. You know, that's recreating something that you're trying to leave behind. And yeah, I can see how that would be a little bit difficult to focus on when you're too busy designing this new thing with a really new way of controlling everything. Yeah, I'm really impressed. Amazingly, I've not really missed the keyboard shortcut, the perceived lack of keyboard shortcut configurability. There's actually more keyboard shortcut configuration than I remember GNOME 2 having. So I'm not missing it at all. I don't really remember GNOME 2 well enough at this point to know if that's even an accurate statement. Maybe it's drastically less, but I'm getting by okay, and I'll get into exactly why I'm getting by okay in a little bit. First, let's talk about some of the negative things about GNOME 3 that I could think of, because I didn't want to just rave about it all the entire time. So some of the, I guess, weaker points is that, for instance, the Alt-Tab convention is a little bit wonky. For instance, if I hit Alt-Tab, I get a pop-up box of each application that's open. That's fine. But they're grouped together. And that, of course, is not what people are generally used to, on Linux at least. So if I hit Alt-Tab to go to my file manager, and I get to my file manager and I have two file windows open, how do I switch between those two? Well, it turns out it's very similar to another OS that I happen to be really familiar with, and it's Alt-Tilde, the key right next to the one, the tilde key. Alt-Tilde will get you within that application between the two open windows. That's something that's quite familiar to me. I don't necessarily love it. I don't necessarily hate it. I'm so used to it that it felt like the minute I saw that that's how it was working, I figured it out. It's like, oh yeah, they're doing that thing. And I tried it, and sure enough, that is what they're doing. It is kind of cool, though, that if you've got two file manager windows open, for instance, and you're doing an alt tab, then underneath the file manager icon, there'll be a little arrow, and if you hover on that, or if you tab over to it and don't release the alt key, then it drops down and shows you what the two windows are that are open, and then you can use the arrow keys to switch between those two. But honestly, I don't see myself ever doing that. I would just alt tab over to it and then alt tilde to get to the specific instance of the file manager that I actually want to see. It's doable. I'm very, very used to that. That's how I'm accustomed to it. But honestly, on my list of things that I like about Linux, one of those things is that when I hit alt tab, it goes to each individual window, no matter what application it's associated with. I really, really like that, actually. It feels a lot more efficient to me. So that's a little tiny gripe that I would have, I guess. Again, not really a deal breaker. No global menu bar. I think if they're gonna do this thing that they're clearly doing, they might as well go for the global menu bar. Come on. You know you want it. Switch over to it. That would make this desktop nearly complete. What is the point of the dock in the application menu? I don't know. Actually, I do know. It's a favorites menu. But there's no easy way to get there. It's just so much easier to just type in, okay, I want to go to Firefox. Okay, then I type in Firefox. Which actually leads me to another pronounced weakness of this. If I type in FI, for instance, I get Firefox, I get FileZilla, I get Archive Manager, I get Files, I get Firewall, I get LibreOffice, Bluetooth. I just get all kinds of different options in my little results screen, and there's no way to say, okay, FI is close enough, now I'm going to arrow over, or I'm going to tab over. There's no way to select from that list. You just have to keep typing no matter what. So if you were looking for, I don't know, FI, I guess if you were looking for File Manager, well, actually, you could just type in Files, which actually is a strength. I think that I kept typing in Nautilus, and I thought, wow, it's such a chore to type in Nautilus. You should just be able to type in Files on any computer and get a file manager. And, well, turns out that's what you can do. But anyway, FI, so if you want something other than your first result, which in this case is FileZilla, if I'm looking for Firefox, then I have to keep typing. Now, I'm still typing just Fire, and I've got Firefox and Firewall, so maybe I wanted Firewall. Well, I narrowed it down to two. It seems like I should just be able to hit Tab or something and tab over to Firewall, but no, I still have to keep typing. So that, to me, was a little bit weird, a little bit weak, and I'm sure that's going to be fixed next release. There's no 4-up or grid view, whatever you want to call it. I call it a 4-up, you know, where you zoom out and look at all your virtual desktops. I didn't find that, at least. Maybe it does exist, and I'm just not looking in the right place. As far as I can tell, it just doesn't really exist. That was a little bit annoying. It seems like if I've got desktops, then I should be able to see all of them, not just as a thumbnail view either. So that was a weakness for me, and related to that is that the virtual desktops are vertical only. You can't use it in a grid pattern. It's just they're going to apparently keep stacking virtual desktops on top of each other, and you have to go down the list of virtual desktops. You can't go over. Having said that, I have definitely found that the grid view of desktops completely boggles the mind of new users. The idea of virtual desktops boggles the mind of new users, period. If you have four, it seems so clear to you and me. It's four virtual desktops. You switch over to the one that you want. No, can't do it. But if you tell them all you have to do is press Windows key and up or down arrow, then that seems to be a lot clearer to them. It still, I think, confuses the people that I've tried to explain it to, but I have noticed that the vertical alignment really, really helps, or just the horizontal, one way or the other, but not the whole grid thing. That seems to be too many directions to think about. I kind of see where they're going on that one, although I don't like it myself. And I guess the other general complaint would be that when you zoom out, you're kind of stuck in that zoom out mode, more or less. I mean, you can unzoom out with the Windows key, the super key, whatever, but you zoom out and there's not really anything you can do. You've got to take your hands off the keyboard and you've got to use the mouse, whether you like it or not. I do regularly find that vaguely annoying. Oh, another annoying thing is that there's this trigger up in the upper left-hand corner, and if you hit your mouse in that upper left-hand corner, it takes you into that zoom-out mode. I don't know why, but my mouse always goes to the upper left-hand corner, and again, this happens on any OS that I'm using, any setup that I'm at. If you give me a mouse, it's going to end up in the upper left corner. And if there's some kind of hot corner action in that corner, then I will trigger it time and time again. And I do it all the time, and I hate it. In KDE, I always have my lower right corner as my little hot point. Sometimes my upper right, strangely enough. You'd think that would be where the clock is. You'd think I'd be going up there a lot. I don't. Those two corners are safe for me. The left side, just no, it's bad for me. So I don't know if that's configurable. I didn't find where it could be configured. So I don't know. That kind of annoyed me. Overall, GNOME 3 is really, really impressive. I find it very, very efficient, actually. I shouldn't say very, very twice. I will say I find it a heck of a lot more efficient than GNOME 2. Of course, the natural question is, well, am I going to switch to GNOME 3 now? Absolutely not. Look, GNOME 3 is not a power user environment. There's just no way to make it look like it's a power user environment. It's just not. It is a great user environment, however. It's fun to use, which for me, that's important. I mean, it's not every environment needs to be fun, you know, I don't care. Although, actually, Flux is pretty fun. So, yeah, there's some heuristic concept of what a fun desktop is for me, and KDE and GNOME 3 and Fluxbox, all three of them fit that model. And actually, so does RatPoison/Emacs. Anything with keyboard splitting of screens, that's okay by me. Yeah, whatever's going on in my brain, this all happens to fit. So it's fun, it's really nice looking, and it is I think it's a simplified interface. And obviously this is the classic complaint against GNOME, and yet it's also the classic primary and foremost feature of GNOME, that it's simplified. And I think that I'm beginning to see what everyone's talking about finally when they say that GNOME is a simple interface. In fact, literally GNOME 3 is the first time I've actually understood what the concept that different people work in different ways. I mean, I knew that logically, but I didn't really get it. But some people, when they sit down to use a computer, they don't want to work in the power user way, and whatever that power user way is for you. For me, it's embodied with KDE, where you have control over every little detail. And I've often said, well, you could just make KDE simplified. You could simplify it so that people don't have all the different options that you would really want yourself to have, and then you'd have a simplified interface for them. It's kind of like you can't have too much power, because you can always just kind of pare it down to something simple. And I still think that you can, but that's going to be extra work for you, the systems configurer. GNOME 3, I really would feel completely safe dropping it in and giving it to a user, not the proverbial grandmother, because those people don't want to learn anything new, but to someone who's interested in a slick-looking free software desktop, this is great. This is beautiful. It's something that I would have confidence in. I wouldn't have any problem supporting it. And I feel like they couldn't screw things up that badly. You know, they're not going to right-click on something and accidentally delete a panel. They just don't have that option. And I realize I could get rid of my right-click in KDE as well, so they may not have that option. But there's something to say for something that you can just drop in and install and hand it back to the person and say, okay, there you go. That's freedom. Have fun with it. And they'll go off and have fun with it. That's how some people like to work. And even the non-noobs, I mean, you yourself might be one of these people. When you sit down at a computer, your workflow might simply fit with the GNOME 3 model. And I think that's fine. And I actually, for the first time, I think I do actually understand that concept, because I found myself thinking, well, you know, I'm going to go right. And I'm just going to be sitting in Emacs with an occasional jump out to Firefox when some page doesn't load correctly in W3C or W3M, whatever that little browser is called. And of course, I'll have a terminal open, but that's a given. Point being, I find myself sitting down and saying, these are the three little tasks that I'm going to be doing. Hey, I could use GNOME 3 for those things. I don't know if anything over three tasks would be something I would want to use GNOME 3 for, personally. But if you're in the mood for a certain kind of workflow, or if that just happens to be your style, then yeah, this I can definitely see this working. So great job, everyone who made GNOME 3 happen. I'm really impressed. And I encourage you to try it out if you haven't tried it personally, if you've been afraid to try it, whatever. Give it a look. It's actually pretty neat. Well, it's time for a cup of coffee, and yes, coffee is still spelled with a K, not a G, if you know what I mean. So, yes, have a good cup of coffee, and then we can start talking about LVM. Welcome back. I hope you had a good cup of coffee. So Christian from Europe somewhere was emailing me a little while ago, and I read some of his emails on the show, and the topic eventually came around to LVM, because I guess I'd had a segment about how to mount LVM on the command line and stuff like that, and he mentioned that LVM was really easy to do on Slackware, and he gave me a couple of tips. So I decided to go ahead and try it, because I knew that LVM was cool, I knew it was powerful, and I was configuring yet another server, and it's probably going to become the main backup server for this place that I work. And I thought, you know, this would be the perfect time to really understand what's going on with LVM, because this backup server could be the server that I just keep adding drives to. You know, it's got like 5 or 6 drive bays, and heck, more space above that where I could maybe even put more drives in if I needed to, and it could just be the backup server, and I could just keep adding to this kind of LVM volume group, and that would be really cool. So I started looking, and that server's actually a Fedora box, so it's going to do the LVM anyway, but I decided that I needed to know what was really going on. The way to do that, of course, is to do the task on Slackware, because you have to understand what you're doing. You can't just say, okay, here's my drive and now make it magically big. You have to actually know how you're doing this and how you're going to care for it and make it do what you want it to do. So, on my Slackware system, I sat down and decided to make a little virtual machine, made a little QEMU Slackware instance, and started going about making a logical volume group. I've done enough Red Hat / Fedora at this point that I kind of know the structure. I kind of get the whole logical volume thing, where I thought I did. And I will say that the command was LVM, and it has a bunch of subcommands. I'm really kind of getting into that lately. I don't know if you've seen these applications. I keep kind of seeing them again and again, where you have the command name, and then like a suite of tools, you know, like publican create, publican build, publican, I don't know, whatever. So there's that. There's screenplay tools that I did. There's another one, well, LVM and then space create LVM whatever. I'm trying to think. I mean, I know I've seen others that do that, and I kind of actually have been getting into that. When I first saw that happen, oh, git was the big one. Git what? Git commit, and then your different command, your different options for the commit part of git. Git push. Well, that's not such a big deal, but git clone and all these little sub command, or git remove and git add. All these little sub commands of the thing that you and I consider Git. I'm kind of starting to like that. It makes sense to me. You know, you know that you want to do something with LVM, so you type in LVM, you hit return, and it tells you, here's all the main applications that I've got as part of LVM. It's kind of this software suite idea, and I like that. So LVM is a little bit like that, and there are couple of different ways to do it, and ultimately it turned out you don't actually have to preface everything with LVM. You can if you want, but you don't have to. So if you type in LVM on Slackware anyway, you get all kinds of results about what the different steps that you can do, and it's a page full, and it's really honestly almost self-explanatory. And I say almost because it only took me a day and 2 different how-tos to actually figure it out, but I was really close. The first time I went through and I did the whole sequence, I did a whole install, I missed one little thing, and I kept missing that thing every single time I went through all these how-tos. The benefit, of course, was that now I actually understand a little bit more than I would have if I'd just kind of faked my way through it. So here's the deal. There's 2 major how-tos for this. One is the LVM how-to, and I believe that I first found that in the user/docs/Linux how-tos or whatever it is on Slackware, where you get all these how-tos. I'm pretty sure that's where I saw it. And then I came across it again on the interwebs, at linuxdig, just like it sounds, linuxdig.com/how-to/LDP, as in Linux Documentation Project, /lvm-how-to.php. It's a great document, explains a lot about LVM. Of course, I know that I've missed a couple of different talks on LVM at various festivals, which I wouldn't have understood at the time anyway, but there's a lot of compelling reasons to go with LVM, and besides the fact that it's really cool. So read that, and there's an Alien Bob how-to as well floating out there somewhere online as well. So between those two things and just kind of the simplicity of the LVM command itself, it's not a difficult task. It's really, really neat to do. So if you want to try it sometime, either use Red Hat or Fedora because they kind of do it for you, or next time you install Slackware on your box, give LVM a shot. It's pretty fun. So the first thing that you do, and I'm going to talk about it in Slackware terms because first of all, that's how I tried it. Second of all, that's really the only distribution that I know well enough to talk about in these terms. So in Slackware, if you boot off of the installer, you're at a command prompt that is pretty pared down, but it's got a lot of kind of preparatory tools that you might need if you were going to install Slackware onto a hard drive. So first thing that you want to do, I think that's the third time I've said that, is set your partitions if these drives have had data on them before, or, well, heck, even if you bought them from the store, they're probably not really ready. I do this through CFDisk. Yes, I like CFDisk. It's easy. You can do it through FDisk, whatever, but you are GNU parted. Whatever you use for your partitioning magic, you would want to do that before you embark on this. Now, I've got two drives, or I had two drives, and I just wanted them to both be one big partition. So, started CFDisk, pointed it at dev SDA. I deleted all the existing partition tables on them and created one big partition that took up the whole drive, marked it bootable, marked it as a Linux formatted file system, or a Linux ready drive, I should say, because it's not actually formatting yet, and then write that out and quit. And I did the same thing to the second one, although I didn't mark that bootable. And so now I've got two drives with one partition each ready to be formatted by MakeFS or even by the Slackware installer. One thing to note here is that while we're doing this LVM thing, you'll sort of have the mental choice. Do you want to do things to dev SDA, or do you want to do things to dev SDA1 or dev SDB or SDB1? The correct answer is 1. You're affecting the thing that is a partition. You're not affecting the device. So dev/SDA1, dev/SDB1, that's what you're doing. That's what you will choose when you're doing all of these LVM commands that you're about to do. Second thing that you want to do at this point would be to make LVM aware that this thing exists. And the way that you do that is to make a physical volume. It's very logical because you do have two physical hard drives in your computer right now in this example. So the first group in that logical volume set that you would want to create is the physical volumes. You have to give a representation of the fact that these two drives exist in reality. They're tangible. So you do a physical volume, although as it is noted somewhere, I think, it doesn't necessarily have to be a hard drive. It could be something that is seen as a hard drive. Not really sure what all that means. Well, I kind of am. I mean, it could be a RAID set, you know, so it wouldn't have to actually be a single hard drive. But we need to make a physical volume that we're going to say, this is our pool of hard drives that we're using for this array, I guess. So you do that with a PV create, that's a physical volume create, PV create /dev/SDA, and if you want to add another drive to it, then it would be /dev/SDB as well, all at one command. So you've just made a physical volume set that contains /dev/SDA and /dev/SDB. Now we want to make a volume group. All this really is giving a name to the pool that we want to create. So now we're kind of getting into the virtual hard drive realm. We don't necessarily need, we might want to have many volume groups and we only have a couple of drives. That's okay, you can do that. Or in this case, it might be the inverse. We might only have two hard drives and we only want one volume group. So we can do that with VG create, that's volume group create, space, for instance, Slack VG, Slack volume group, and then that's the name of our volume group. We're just creating that. You can make up any name you want. And then we tell what drives we actually want to add to that volume group. And in this case, again, it's /dev/SDA and /dev/SDB. I'm sorry, SDA1 and SDB1. You do want to create you want to use the partition names, not the device names. So you've got VG create space slack VG space slash dev slash SD81 space slash dev slash SDB1. Now we've taken both of those entire hard drives and we've crammed them into one volume group. So that would be some kind of logical volume group that we as system administrators would want to know, okay, those two drives are a member of this physical volume, and this physical volume right now contains one volume group. Simple enough. If you want to see what you've done so far, you can use LVM space PV scan, it's physical volume scan, and that will return a list of all your physical volumes. If you want to see the volume groups that you're creating so far, LVM space VGS volume group scan, I guess, space slack VG, because we want to look at our slack VG scan, and it will show us a slack VG. The physical volume is 1, the logical volume groups is 0 so far. Attributes, volume size, it could be 120 gigabytes, it could be 12 gigabytes, it can be whatever whatever the two drives that you've now basically tied together are, that's what it's going to be. It will tell you how much space you have free on that volume group as well. Okay, so we've got we've got a volume group all tied into one physical volume. Now we need to split that volume group up, and this is of course the real power of LVM, is that you can take a big pool of space that may span any number of hard drives and divvy it up in any arbitrary number that you want. These are called the logical volumes, and this is at least what I think of when you say LVM to me. I'm not thinking of the physical volume. I'm not thinking of the volume groups necessarily. I'm really thinking of the logical volumes. So these are basically the partitions. So for instance, let's say we're doing a basic Slackware install, nothing fancy yet. We'll just do LV create space dash L, capital L, space 20 gigs, 20 and then a capital G, space dash N for a name, space root, this is root spelled out because we're calling it, okay, this is our root partition, space slack VG. That creates a virtual partition or a logical volume in the volume group slack VG by the name of root, and the size of it is 20 gigabytes. Then we can do an LV create space dash L, capital L, 99 gigs, space in, as in name, and we'll call that home, because that's where we'll put all of our home folders, and space slack VG. So again, we're creating a logical volume called home. It's 99 gigabytes, and it's in the volume group of slack VG. And finally, we could do an LV create dash L, 2 gigabytes, space dash N, swap, space slack VG. So now we've got a logical volume called swap. I bet you can guess what we're going to do with that. It's 2 gigabytes in size, and it's on the volume group slack VG. Now we can make device nodes, and you do that with a VG scan space dash dash MK nodes, and then we'll activate the volumes. And you do that with VG change space dash AY, and it will confirm for you that yes, slack VG is now, or this volume group is now active. Okay, so before we start the setup of actually installing the operating system, at this point we would want to do a make swap, because we need to earmark this swap partition as swap space. So you do make swap space slash dev slash slack VG slash swap. Okay, so now you're ready to install. So you run the Slackware installer as usual. You would type in setup, for instance. Bring up the menu-driven installer that Slackware uses. It's pretty simple. You install everything nearly as if though there was nothing special about this, other than the fact that you need to make sure that you're choosing the logical volumes for your mount points. So you'll do the add swap step, and that'll find the swap partition that we just prepared automatically. Then when you go to install, it will ask you which partition to use. It will detect the logical volumes, and you'll see them. They'll be dev slash slack VG slash root slash dev slash slack VG slash home. Then you will also see a slash dev slash SDA 1, I think, and that will have all of the space available on it. That's not what you want to use. If you use that, you're screwing up the entire logical volume scheme that we've just spent all this time creating, so don't choose that. You choose the logical volumes that you've spent time creating, and you set their mount points to whatever you want them to be. So the root, of course, will default to root, and then when you choose home, it will ask you to define what other than root you want that to be, and you can just type in slash home, and then you'll continue. Everything will go as normal until you get to the install Lilo screen. This is not going to work. You will be able to install Lilo or sort of seem like you're going through it. And I did the expert Lilo install just to try to get around it. But even the expert one, it doesn't work. It's not going to work because it doesn't make allowances for LVM at all or make initrd at all. So you just let Lilo fail. I go ahead and generate the stuff because then you get a nice little /lilo.conf file that you can start from, but it will not work. You also want to make sure that even though it's failing, you are installing it to the master boot record. It's very important. If you install it, this is actually the step that I kept getting wrong. If you install it to, and it's a stupid mistake, but if you install it to the root, then guess where the root is? Well, the root is inside of the logical volume. Guess what your computer's BIOS is not going to be able to detect and boot from before you actually get Linux up and running? Yeah, a logical volume. So install that Lilo prompt or that Lilo menu to master boot record. Very important to do that. So you continue the install. It goes completely as normal. It'll just fly by in no time. Very simple. And then at the end, rather than restarting your computer, definitely don't want to do that yet, you simply choose the exit selection from the menu, and that drops you back down into a root prompt. So now we're back out in that little installer environment, or the sort of pre-setup environment. Turns out that Slackware, after it's installed and everything, mounts your new system into /mnt/mount/mnt by default. So all we need to do is chroot into /mnt. And to do that, you simply say chroot space /mnt, although you'll have better luck if you type it and not just say it. And then you can use this really cool little make initrd generator script that Christian from Europe actually told me about. That is found in the /usr/share/makeinitrd/makeinitrd_command_generator.sh. So you're at a root prompt. You've chrooted into /mnt, so it's completely safe to simply issue the command. I do /, although I don't really have to do the /, but /usr/share/mkinitrd/mkinitrd_command_generator.sh. That runs a handy little makeinitrd generator script, and it returns a suggestion of what a sensible and workable makeinitrd command would be. It's really, really easy. It makes your life very simple. My command, for instance, was mkinitrd /2.6.37.6-smp/fext3/r/dev/slackvg/root/m, something about the memory and stuff for ext3, it's too complex to repeat, -L /U /O /boot/initrd.gz. So you copy that right into the command that you're sitting on, and it will run mkinitrd for you. It will add the modules that you need for that initial boot, you know, the ext3 module and the LVM module, I'm sure, and all of these other little modules that you're going to need in order to get a system running, and it drops the initrd into /boot. So that's your little RAM drive, and you kind of are going to need that to be accessible, and you're going to kind of need that to be something that Lilo knows how to find. Therefore, the next step is going to be to edit the /etc/lilo.conf file. It's a really simple thing. I did a ls/boot/vmlinux-generic, and then let it auto fill out that name for me and piped that, redirected the result of that list into /etc/lilo.conf. But if you have a good memory, you can remember the name of the kernel that you're going to want to boot is, well, it's in /boot, that's kind of a given, and the name of it is vmlinux-generic-smp-2.6.37.6-smp. That was a little bit much SMPs and numbers for me, so I just cheated. Point being that in the /etc/lilo.conf file, go down to the very bottom where it lists the partitions that are bootable, and for the image that you want to use, you want to make sure that you're using the generic kernel, because the huge kernel is too large for initial RAM disk, so you want to use the generic one. At least this is what I read. I didn't try the huge. You could try the huge. I went ahead and used the generic, because it generally does work for me, actually. And it's /boot/vm-linux-generic-smp-2.6.37.6-smp. So that's the kernel that you want to boot. And then you need to add a brand new line, which will be /rd=/boot/initrd.gz. So that's the RAM drive that we just created with that make initrd command. The rest really should be the same. I mean, the root partition is already correct. That's /dev/slackvg/root. The label, you can put it to anything. I just say Linux, but you can put LVM Linux or whatever you want for the label. That's just the human readable thing in your little menu. And of course, it'll be read-only. So save that, and then of course, you must run the lilo command. So type in L-I-L-O. That resets all of the lilo settings or whatever it resets somewhere, probably the master boot record. I don't know. It'll generate some errors, but you can ignore those, because basically lilo's freaking out because it's insisting that what you're telling it doesn't actually match what it sees in its files in its proc or something like that. Don't worry about it. We know better. And now you can finally reboot. When you reboot, of course, the master boot record will come up right away, and that'll be the lilo screen. You should see your selection for the LVM thing that you've just done. You should hit return on that. It should boot right from its RAM disk, and then of course, as that gets the system up and running and gets the LVM up and online, it starts to load in all the other stuff. And you've got it. You've got a logical volume group on Slackware. And now you know really what's going on behind the scenes on something like Fedora. Because I admit, like I've said, I've done Fedora installs plenty of times, and I always click that review the partitions after you do it automatically for me, and I look at it and I see what's going on, but I never really understood it. Now I do. That's about all I've got for you today, I think. So thank you very much for listening. And, of course, you can always contact me on the interwebs a couple of different ways. There's email, klaatu@member.fsf.org. There is Jabber, not klaatu@jabber.org. And there's Freenode. And I'm usually not klaatu on Freenode in the, for instance, Ogcast Planet channel, in the Slacker Media channel, lots of other Linux-y channels. And you can find the website at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
So was there anything you wanted to apologize to me for?